Welcome back to If This Then That, a podcast from Berg School of Communication that's all about strategy. My name's Adam Horn, and today I'm again joined by
Michael Anito, and today we're going to be talking about adaptation.
I'm very curious to see your take on this. I think, once again, I think I've got a very different compass point for adaptation. So,
you know, there isn't necessarily a right or wrong perspective, just a bunch of different ones. And maybe it's about picking the one that's most relevant for you and your situation.
When I say the word adaptation and I say the word strategy, where does your head jump to, or where do you go in your mind, in that vast, considerable mind of yours?
I'm not so sure about that, but what I am sure about, though, is where adaptation starts for a brand. And for me, it starts in its foundation. And what I think is becoming more and more useful for brands is to be able to kind of adapt and almost like mold themselves to different situations without actually changing their foundation, right? As part of our course, we have, we kind of like begin with like, what are the kind of principles that a brand should have, any brand? And we have four of them: synthesis, distinction, interaction, iteration. And all of them are basically inherently, they're inherently adaptive, if you like. One adaptive from, you know, pulling different things together. One is kind of thinking about how you stand out. Another one is, how things work together. And of course, the final one, iteration, is just all about how you always like change things and optimize things based on what you're listening to and where you're trying to go. What do you think about when we talk about adaptation?
I mean, we'll get to that in a sec. I've just got a couple of little questions for you. Do you think people talk about adaptation in various different ways, but use different words or use different kinds of language around it?
I think so. But I think it's always good to use the most simplest way of describing something, and maybe a way that's natural, if you like.
Yeah.
Maybe a marketing type term is transformation, right? Or ability to transfer.
Save us all from that phrase.
And, you know, if I chuck in the word agile in there as well, you know?
Oh, I've got shivers.
So I think it's, you know, it's just like it's a general trait, right? You know, being adaptive to the things that are relevant for a brand. And what are those things? It's the business. It's kind of like the brand, it's the consumer, it's the marketplace, it's the marketing environment, all of these things.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a bit of work in social media, and a lot of these topics turn up and get called like flexibility or responsiveness or being dynamic. So I'm just wondering, do you think there's overlap with that kind of language with the language of like describing something as adaptation or adoptive?
Yes, I think so. There's loads of different ways of talking about, adaptation and being adaptive. And none of them are wrong, if you like, but it's maybe just good to choose one which encompasses the whole thing.
And your point earlier about it being very much in the core or the DNA of organizations is really true. I think like adaption isn't something that you do once and then come back and meet everyone in 5 years and then readopt and set a new compass or set a new direction. To use sailing parlance, it's a little bit like keeping a light hand on the rudder, on the steering of a boat.
Right.
It's like you're not making big muscular changes of direction, but you've always got a fingertip on there to adjust.
There's something I always think about when I think about adaptation, and I think of octopuses.
Hmm.
Just simply because they are the, if you think, I mean, of course, they're like intelligent and all of that stuff, but if you think about how they use their bodies, how they use their senses, how they react to danger, how they're kind of like curious, how they can kind of like fit in a tiny space but spread over a big area. I think that's almost how, brands and businesses should think about themselves, and think about that foundation. It's still the same thing, but it adapts, but it also affects as well. Adaptation shouldn't be passive, right? It's not necessarily about just reaction.
Yeah, it's a really nice metaphor. And it's also like, you know, an octopus doesn't just respond to their context or their environment. They kind of preempt it. So they know that they're moving, you know, into different environments and they kind of preemptively adjust accordingly. That's really nice. I mean, octopuses are freaky to think about too much, but as a metaphor, I think that works.
Cool.
Do you think a lot of businesses or organizations have a problem with being with adaptation or getting into that place where they're agile enough or flexible enough?
Yeah, of course, and justifiably so. If you think about the different aspects of a business, you know, not least people, you know, logistics, products, supply chain, marketing. Of course, I'd say the bigger the business, the more the need for adaptation. But you know, the harder it is to actually implement on an ongoing basis.
I often think about organizations that are in the middle of their life or that are not new and that either need to pivot or adjust.
Right.
So I really think that's where my mind intuitively goes.
Right.
You know, a nice local example is how Volvo start to see themselves as a bit more of a holistic transport company. And you see that a bit. You see big players in a category assuming all of the responsibilities of the wider category. But it means that you can be a bit more flexible. It's like you can go from selling probably fairly expensive cars to doing stuff as a service, and you know, mm-hmm. you can stop. It's that adaptation is that process of stopping and adjusting.
No, I see this, the kind of like stopping and adjusting, though it's more now about just listening.
Yeah.
And kind of constantly optimizing.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yes, absolutely. So, Michael, in your opinion, what are some bits of advice on how to take a more adaptive approach?
I think there's some really interesting examples of companies, which we'll get on to a little bit later. And broadly speaking, I think you have to you almost have to like compartmentalize different parts of the business.
Yeah.
Right. So going back to my like octopus analogy.
No, I love it. Let's keep going.
Like the, basically an octopus is like when you look at the way that it manages its body, all of its kind of different organs, sensors and so on, it's almost like a distributed network, right? Rather than everything centralized into just like one core. Each of them can each of them almost like think by themselves, and then they all make one organism, as opposed to it all being in one place.
Yeah.
And for me, that's how good businesses should take a forward-thinking, adaptive approach, which is understand the different elements of your business. I kind of call it a framework.
Yep.
And then almost have each of those frameworks as almost like little mini ecosystems in amongst themselves. And then they are not just like acting and, if you like, reacting to what that part of the framework needs, but also what the whole kind of like needs, if you like. And that means you need to kind of think of your business. Right. Okay. Let's think of communication.
Yeah.
Let's think of marketing. Let's think of operations. Let's think of distribution, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that, but it sounds like you need to set yourself up for this, because it feels
exactly.
It's like a great footballer who's in the right position at the right time. You know, he doesn't, you know, you need to be moving into that space before the ball is kicked. You can't be,
right.
You can't wait for the ball to be kicked to run to the right place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And you train to always be in the right place. You know, it's amazing how lucky people who train obsessively.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, the correlation between luck and effort is tightly interwoven. Yes.
But also part of the adaptation, I think, as well, think on a little bit more, is also not just this kind of like compartmentalization of stuff, but also the knowledge of the value
yep.
of those elements as well, right? So it's not just about seeing a change, seeing an opportunity, seeing a space
yeah.
for a brand to move in, but it's also, okay, what's the risk reward equation here? What's it going to bring to not just that, you know, that department or that, you know, that arm of the octopus, but also what's it going to do for the rest of
yeah.
what's it going to do for the rest of me?
You want to see the wider play or the wider ramifications.
But it's kind of like a, I think it's also a, I think we touch on a theme quite a few times so far, which is just this adaptation has to be holistic, right? For it to be really effective.
Yeah.
Which I think is just like an ongoing theme with brands and businesses, like this this understanding that everything is connected, basically. Even if it looks like it's just affecting one part, it could affect adversely or positively another part as well.
Yeah, there's a the consequences are somewhat predictable and somewhat unpredictable. And I think it's all predicated a little bit on the idea that human brains and organizations love routine. So we like to work it out on one day and then just like go switch to autopilot. And I feel like you can do that in your apartment. You know, you unpack all your boxes and you mainly leave your stuff where you unpack it. You don't often completely reorganize your apartment very often, even though over time you learn that there's probably a better way of adjusting things. But I think organizations have this same, how would you describe, you'd almost describe it like a like an unwillingness to really think deeply about things or to really ask big questions because you kind of want to do what you did yesterday.
I think you touched on a really interesting point because I've worked with a lot of companies that do the first part of adaptation or being adaptive,
okay.
which is they do the listening part or they do the watching, the you know, the analysis.
Yeah.
They ask the right questions, which is, right, what we know we need to do something or we're thinking about doing something or whatever it is. They don't actually do it because of that inertia
yeah.
that you talk about, right? You know, there's this kind of, you know, not necessarily unwillingness to change, but this ease that you slip into routine. And I think that part is as hard as, you know, the finding out what it is you need to kind of change or adjust. The discipline to go, right, now it's time to act on it.
Yeah.
And it's completely understandable, right? Things are easiest when you don't need to change them.
No, exactly.
But what I would encourage people to think about is imagine the adaptation part being the thing you don't change.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective.
It's the thing that, okay, we know we always have to. And you see that in, you know, just successful organizations, right?
Yeah.
You look at their communications, you know, 1 year and you think this is the best thing I've ever seen. And then 3 years later, 2 years later, they're doing something else because it's this... the one thing that they have in there is that, you know, we always have to adapt in a relevant way for our business.
Yeah, there's almost a restlessness there. You know, they're not high-fiving each other years after a great product or service or campaign or whatever. They're just like, they're still hungry. It almost makes them hungry, that success.
Restlessness is a funny word because I love it.
I love it too, yes. I see it as positive. A lot of people don't.
A lot of people see it as exhausting, basically, in the sense of, right, so we've just done this thing and now we've got to do it again and we've got to do it again. And you do actually see that in people that you know who work in ad agencies
yep.
or work in marketing companies, particularly one where there's like this pace of stuff.
Yeah.
That's why I actually kind of like the idea of adaptation being something you don't change.
Yeah, no, it's an ongoing, you don't finish it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like, oh, that's actually, that's maybe quite a calming thought way of looking at it, even if it means you're always evolving and transforming stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, an octopus keeps moving, an athlete keeps training. You know, you don't get ready for the Olympics, get perfectly ready one day. You know, you can't just do. You've got to kind of keep moving.
Absolutely. We talked earlier about compartmentalization and those different areas, but I think there's just like really four simple areas you can think about constantly adapting or being aware of. Obviously, what's happening with your brand,
yep.
What's happening with your consumer, what's happening in the business, and then what you need from a marketing perspective. It doesn't matter what process chart or what organigram you have or, you know, whichever business you're envisioning. When you hear us talking about this, I think if you think of those just four areas as the places that you need to think about adapting, you know, from a brand strategy perspective, you're gonna be good in more cases than not.
I'm not gonna argue with that. I think you've done more thinking about this than I have.
So Adam, actually, this makes me wonder, what are examples of adaptation that you think are, you know, really kind of like impressive or the ones that are kind of like best in class?
There's a couple. There's one that is big and boring, and it's done it so well that no one has really noticed, but it's because it's a bit boring. I really like Microsoft. So Microsoft went from the company, if you're old enough to remember, that sold boxes of software, yep, in, you know, big box retailers, in the stores. They went from, you know, having companies run their own server infrastructure in the basement of their seven-story building. And then over time, they developed to being the number two cloud provider behind Amazon. And they went from this kind of Windows first world where like Windows is the king, all of our software, you know, Office, Excel, Word, all that stuff works best in a Windows world, to being a little bit nicer and kind of getting to a place where it's like, we are everywhere that our customers want us to be. So they've got a really big presence on iOS and Android and all that stuff.
Right.
And they've done it really smoothly. And I don't know if everyone's noticed how well they've adapted to the modern world.
I think it's a great example.
It's boring.
It is, but, you know, they're, what, the second biggest company in the world? I think,
yeah,
maybe
I think so.
Second or third. What's really impressive about this example, Adam, is that there was a very kind of like clear perception maybe about 10 years ago that Microsoft was kind of like behind the times, that they'd somehow missed the boat, that their business would kind of like die as the physical formats that their software came on and the whole thing around licensing died.
Exactly. And they were deeply uncool.
Absolutely. There was a point where, yeah, absolutely.
As a brand.
And I don't know if they're cool as a brand now, but I think as a business brand, you know, even from a B2B perspective, I think they're pretty highly respected.
Now I'm going to ask you, do you have any brands or organizations that jump out for you?
I do, actually. The one that springs to mind when I was thinking about this episode is Burberry.
Yeah, I think, okay, that's interesting. I'm curious to hear what you've got to say about this one.
Burberry, and most people listening to this will know who Burberry is and that it's a classic, if not iconic, British brand. Burberry have been a little bit a darling of digital marketing up until maybe a couple of years ago, simply because of how fantastic their digital strategy and their digital brand marketing was for, you know, maybe 10 or so years. And what I think is really best in class about how Burberry adapt is that they look across those four areas of the brand, of their customer, business and marketing, and they're not afraid to make fundamental changes.
Yeah, I think that really separates them from some of their peers.
Exactly, right? And even to this, even when you think about their product, they've gone from like an iconic brand to like a luxury brand, right? And so they have this like foundation which they kind of like adapt and mold with the times. And the way that they think about their business, if you look at their, even if you look at their like corporate statements and how they talk about their strategy, I've been looking at this for like the last 10 or so years, really well thought through, really kind of like comprehensive, and it goes all the way through to execution. I love the way that they've almost, they take an aspect of their brand, which is all around kind of like authenticity and integrity. And they apply it really well to what they do from a charitable perspective and in a really relevant way. And when you look at, you look at the current situation, there's a reason why they actually make money from their factories to produce PPE for the British government. It's because they're really well organized to adapt. It's not a marketing thing. It's not like some post on LinkedIn. It's like, no, we're going to do this. And then suddenly they get £600,000 pounds from the government to actually bona fide do that. Flip side of that, at the same time, they are supporting...
Yes, go on.
They're supporting Marcus Rashford, right? In his kind of like fight to like help young people in the UK, not on the food side, but just kind of like on the kind of like skills development side. And they can do all of that stuff because they have this adaptive brand, because they have this adaptive foundation, and they can turn around and go, right, our strategy from top to bottom is this 1 year. They execute it over like 3 or 4 years, and then they pivot and they turn to another fundamental strategy. But it's all built on that sound base. So I think they're like a really interesting example that has this business that seemingly works worldwide as well, right? So they've got a fantastic business in China. They've got retail locations. They've got this e-commerce powerhouse. They do collaborations, but they're also making PPE, you know, all of this stuff. They do luxury, but they also do youth development projects, all because of that foundation.
Yeah, my view of Burberry is kind of as an outsider and really looking at the executional stuff. So my background is in design and art direction. So when you see such radical repositioning of their look and feel, and you see such categoric shifts that are really confident, you see what you're looking at is a really well-managed organization. So it doesn't surprise me when you mention their approach to PPP is kind of bang on.
There's a word you use there, which is really powerful, and that is confidence, right? So
yeah, they're confident. They feel confident when they do something. They don't half do it.
Exactly. And I think, you know, they feel and they seem confident because they have this sound foundation. They know what they're adapting. They know what they're adapting. They've thought about this like past state, present state, and future state. And that's the other last thing I would say about Burberry, which is, you know, there's going to be something else.
Okay.
So, you know, there's something very timely about what they do, because sometimes you get this impression from some brands that they're going to do this thing and now we're going to do it forever. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's like,
yes.
No, they're like, no, yeah, we're doing this because of this, you know, and, and you know, we'll be doing this until this thing is done. And then you just know, just the language they use is of constant evolution, adaptation, and it being intelligent adaptation as well.
Yeah, and I think they're really good at balancing their heritage with their future, whereas lots of brands can easily, you know, with that history, turn into a legacy brand that kind of looks in the rearview mirror a bit too much. They're also really good at managing their Englishness in a really international environment. Lots of French brands are good at that, but that's a weird French fashion thing. Yeah, it's interesting. Burberry's a really interesting example. And it's like, it's a wildly different brand on the outside than Microsoft. But then when you look at it a little bit closer, there's a lot of things that they do have in common.
Indeed.
Anything else that jumps out? Any other organizations or brands or things that take your fancy?
I mean, a boring example is Facebook. So through acquisition, but also through, you know, feature and functionality evolution, they're highly adaptive. You know, from the get-go, and are becoming even more so as they react, not just to kind of like technological change, but to societal change as well. I know people kind of like love to hate them at the moment, but I think if, I think if you're disregarding the positive aspects of what they do from a brand strategy perspective, then you're probably missing a trick. They are very, very, very good at being adaptive.
Yeah, they are. And I think like part of their genius was adapting to create Facebook almost as a holding company for other brands to grow in a way that makes sense in their ecosystem.
Absolutely. Changing their operating model.
It's very easy to pile on Facebook, and that's another episode, but it's like, I don't think I would like to be responsible for the social media with 2 billion monthly active users.
It's not easy. Like we were saying, if the adaptation isn't easy when you're talking about internal stuff, imagine when you've got 2 billion non-paying customers to keep sweet, basically.
Non-paying
customers.
But I feel like that's another episode. That's a whole other podcast series.
Absolutely.
The last one that I want to mention as a really nice adaptation is there's a few scooter companies here in Stockholm, at least, and I probably imagine in 2020 coronavirus year, other companies are doing it, but they're electric scooter companies that are moving towards subscription models. So instead of just being like a thing you try a little bit, they're squaring up as a replacement for your, you know, your Metro travel card. So like an alternative for your Oyster card in London or your card here in Stockholm. And I think that's really interesting.
Absolutely. I think the whole area of subscription, I think it is interesting. If you have enough funding or cash reserves to, you know, operate a business whilst building up a subscription base, then I think you're really building up your consumer profiling, your data profiling for the future. Subscriptions, where it's all at. When you look at businesses that have kind of died recently, like Quibi, you know Quibi, right?
Quibi, we hardly knew you.
And good riddance.
I mean, the Quibi was, I think it was dead. It was never alive. I don't know. Maybe we'll cut this bit out, but it feels like it felt like a whole bunch of old Hollywood people being like, kids love. And the kids were like,
so that's why I think it's a really good example, because the brands we're talking about here are like Jeffrey Katzenberg, right? You know, this is the Spielbergs who put the money in it. They are the brands who are trying to adapt to today's media environment, and they did it horribly. But I think the real the reason why it pulled the plug is a business very clearly can lose tens, hundreds of millions of euros, dollars, call it what you will. But if they have enough of a customer base where investors can see the value of that, fine. And in for Quibi's case, same thing with like Disney Plus and Netflix, it's all about subscribers. They didn't have the subscribers, basically, for it to continue.
Amazon's a good example of like investors will come on the journey and forego short-term rewards if there's a long-term play that makes sense.
Right, exactly. And that play being big enough or simple enough that the business can adapt in order to make that play. You know what I mean? To be able to take advantage
100%.
Of it. Quibi didn't have that.
The art director in me really loves their logo. I feel like they could sell that logo to someone else because it's a waste of a really beautiful logo. But no one's mentioned that in any of the press coverage, but maybe the art directors out there are crying.
The Quibi logo is no more. So, Adam, you usually ask me what my golden rule or golden rules are of our theme, and this week it's adaptation. So this week I'm asking you.
My reason isn't usually completely altruistic. It's usually I'm trying to steal half of your idea and adapt it when you ask me. But if I have to go first, exactly. If I have to think about it and go first, my golden rule would be to look outside of your category or even the business that you're in, and even look outside of the consumers that are giving you feedback. Look at worlds where you don't think you can learn something and see what you can learn. So,
right.
What can you learn from NBA coaches in basketball? What can you learn from Machiavellian kind of philosophy? Look further away, because I think we live in a little bit of a world that fetishizes customer feedback.
Right.
And I'm sure you'll remember this famous Henry Ford quote, which is like, if I asked customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse.
Right.
So I think they can help you make smaller adjustments, but I don't think they're going to help you invent the thing that is going to replace your business in a positive way.
Right.
So that would be my tip for my golden rule for adaptation. Michael, what about you? What's your golden rule?
Mine is I think it's the thing I've said earlier, really, which is just think about, you know, those four areas, the brand, the customer, the business, the marketing, and just use those as the basis for adaptation, because everything kind of like a little bit flows from that. And I think if you kind of start simply, then you get to manage the complexity better.
I think it's really nice to break it into those four discrete areas, because every organization culturally or organizationally will have some areas that are harder to nudge out of their routine than others. So it's nice to see that list and be able to be like, okay, where do we need to spend our time and effort?
Exactly. Often, I think sometimes I'm hearing some feedback from listeners is that sometimes you have people who are listening to this who are basically like entrepreneurs and who are doing it all by themselves. And conversely, we have some listeners who work in, you know, multinational corporations and large advertising agencies and so on. So it's really interesting to think about which things work for everyone. You've been listening to If This Then That with me, Michael Anito.
And me, Adam Horn.
And we'll be seeing you next week when we'll be talking about simplicity. In the meantime, take care and be safe out there.
Bye.